to it once, to record it, and to recreate it perfectly. I had been part of the process of creating the song. I had heard it for hours and hours in the studio. Even I couldn't sit down and play it cold. I called the engineer, Steve, who was working on the record. "I'm coming over to the studio," I said. I wanted to see if I could play the same part again, the way he did. It was a challenge, like watching a magic show and then trying to cut the lady in half and put her back together yourself. I failed miserably. The lady was in pieces. I felt like a loser, man. I didn't understand how he had done it. I was recreating a person who had recreated me, and I couldn't even be me as well as he had. But I didn't even for a second feel something about it. How could I? All Dilla was doing was taking something I had made and making something new from it, even as he was also making a copy. He was creating because I had created. With a different kind of person, a different kind of producer, a different kind of talent, I might have felt one-upped or put down, or, but I didn't even feel a twinge of that. I was just amazed. Dilla was one of two people I have ever met who have that talent of hearing something, absorbing it, and being able to put it right back out there. The other one is Tariq. He has an amazing brain for that. You can put him in a room, have him listen to a tape of the Gettysburg Address once, and then smash the tape because you don't need it anymore. It's all in his head. Dilla was able to create in a way I didn't understand, which isn't typically the first thing I think about when I think about mentorship. I would have thought it was more about teaching certain skills, refining them, identifying what's there and what's not there. And yet, Dilla's ability to make the street seem like it was a two-way street, like everyone was inspiring everyone. His talent for making sure that there was an absence of malice in any direction probably helped to bring the story to a happy conclusion. At the time, we were still working on Reel to Reel, not Pro Tools. When the tape was slowing down and I heard my failed attempt to do what Dilla was doing, I had the engineer flip the tape backward. I heard something new. I used it as the intro music for the Mo Better Blues dialogue that we included on Things Fall Apart. It was a Mo Meta situation that ended up Mo Better for everyone. It's a successful story of creativity. And how Dilla's example led me to some Zen conclusion regarding new ways of creating by using old material in a new way. But it's also a stellar example of the kind of influence and mentorship that last into old age. It may not have been a perfectly frictionless process. It was frustrating to go into the studio and discover I couldn't do what he had done. But it created a frictionless memory that continues to pay dividends. The mismatch is the match. Attach yourself to people who are doing things you don't quite understand. Getting started. A good cup of coffee. Creativity sometimes results in products, but it's always a process. Ideas, including those destined for your brain, are moving past you all the time, in a constant stream. It's a matter of capturing them. But what happens when you can't get into the stream? What happens on those mornings when you feel sluggish or hungover, or where you've run into your most annoying friend on your way to the office or studio, and when you sit down to add your brilliant manuscript or album or series of paintings, and you just can't get the ideas to tumble forth from your head? In these cases, you need to get the wheels in motion. What's the best way to do that? I have long had an interest in finding out the answers from other creative people. They vary widely. Here are some in no particular order. Coffee, long walk, short walk, climb stairs, look out a window, coffee. Jot down the names of everyone you know in reverse alphabetical order. Meditate. Listen to the radio. Coffee. Go to a diner and eat scrambled eggs. Count to 10 forward and backward. Read a page of a book upside down. Call a wrong number on purpose. Type, all work and no play makes Jack a dull boy, 1,000 times. Whittle. Coffee. So many people say coffee. I don't drink coffee. The only time I've been known to indulge is when I drink 2 triple espressos before a movie so I can stay awake. And my date still ends up elbowing me mid-snore. Well, let's start there. And something to food about, I spoke to a chef named Ryan Roadhouse, who started a pop-up restaurant called Notoguro in Portland, Oregon. Ryan had one of the most interesting creative processes of any chef I spoke to. When he started out, he cooked for people in a kind of supper club. His wife helped him by making the table settings. He enlisted all the other artists he knew to design the space. At some point, he thought his ideas were played out. He didn't know what he could do to bring people back a second time or a third. What he did was both convenient and profound. He went to other people's works to jumpstart his own ideas. His first source was the work of Haruki Murakami. He noticed that Murakami's characters ate all kinds of strange foods, and hear the wind sing a man poured Coca-Cola over his pancakes as a kind of makeshift syrup. He used those strange fictional foods as starting points and started to invent his own. After Ryan cooked the dishes out of Murakami, he did another month devoted to a Japanese visionary. This time he cooked the foods from the movies of Hayao Miyazaki. The third time, he came back to America, specifically to Twin Peaks, the seminal, disturbing, and surreal television show created by David Lynch and Mark Frost. Everyone who has seen the show remembers Agent Dale Cooper, played by Kyle MacLachlan, and his love for pie and coffee. Ryan's Twin Peaks menu had a strange and happy ending. While I was writing something to food about, I thought it would be interesting to have him cook it for Lynch himself. And me, of course. David doesn't like to travel much, so Portland was out of the question. And I arranged for the dinner to happen in Los Angeles at the Chateau Marmont. And there I was, eating Twin Peaks themed food with David Lynch himself in Bungalow 3. Talk about surreal. Lynch loved the dishes, which included coffee cup custard, chawanmushu with black trumpet gel and freeze-dried corn, and turnip Waldorf salad with miso and fresh apple. He told us a bunch of amazing stories, including the origin of the moment in Twin Peaks where Dale Cooper and Sheriff Harry S. Truman, Michael Ontkean, are about to drink a cup of coffee, and Pete Martell, Jack Nance, runs into the room. "Fellas, don't drink that coffee," he says. "There was a fish in my percolator." The scene came from a real story in a real diner he used to frequent. One of his friends took a sip of coffee and spit it out. It tasted terrible. They investigated, and it turned out that someone had left a bar of lava soap in the percolator. Lynch is obsessed with diners and coffee, partly because they help him create a meditative space where he can have his strangest ideas. In Catching the Big Fish, his book about creativity, he puts it this way. There's a safety in thinking in a diner. You can have your coffee or your milkshake, and you can go off into strange dark arts and always come back to the safety of a diner. I appreciate the coffee method, though I don't drink that much coffee myself. Rather than jumpstart my ideas, it just makes me jumpy. On days when I feel like I have no ideas in my head, I usually try to go to the track. During track meets, athletes stretch. They're prepared for weeks, for months, for years. But there's still important daily preparation. I've seen them there off on the side just before meet. They touch their toes. They hop up and down. They crane their necks from side to side. The reason is that no one wants to start the competition with a pull or a twinge. A tiny little malfunction somewhere in the musculoskeletal system can sideline an athlete completely. I recommend something similar for creativity. It's no less demanding than an athletic competition. In some ways, you can argue that it's more demanding. So learn to stretch your brain, too. Here are some strategies. Garden. I don't mean this literally, though feel free to take it literally if you have access to a garden. When I've had the opportunity to do that, or when I've met people who do that, they find it immensely gratifying. They notice things that they wouldn't ordinarily notice. Their senses sharpen. Their heart rate slows down. Many mornings I try to do something equally zen-like, and most of the time that means going into my MP3 catalog and pruning it. I notice song titles. I notice how things are organized. That starts me towards thinking about my own work in a structured creative context. It puts me in contact with other work that motivates without intimidating. That may work for you if you have hundreds of thousands of MP3s on your hard drive. If not, try something similar. Reshelve your books. Take the photographs off the wall and hang them up again. You can rearrange them or try to recreate them in the same arrangement. Put yourself in contact with creative work in some fashion through organizing. It's certain to loosen you up in the right way. Play it backward. When we see things one way, mostly, we are at the mercy of common paradigms. That's why conventional wisdom has such a hold on us. Remember when Donald Trump started to ascend through the Republican primary season? People couldn't believe it because it didn't match what they already knew of politics. And speaking of politics, I won't anymore. At least not the topic of what's-his-name's unlikely rise into the presidency. As the great philosophers Darrell Hall and John Oates said, some things are better left unsaid. I've talked in other places about an exercise that Richard Nichols and Ben Greenman like to do, which involves believing in the opposite of what you believe. Do you think that humans are affecting the climate? Believe they are not, just for a minute. Are you sure that Oswald acted alone? Embrace conspiracy, just for a minute. This exercise is something different. Take a piece of art that you love and invert it. If it's a painting or a photograph, it's easy. Just turn it upside down. If it's on your phone, the screen may try to rotate with you, but you can lock it. And if you can't lock it, stand on your head. If it's a book, read from the last page forward. Stop at every word. Girl, later. Mingus, later. That's the end of Charles Mingus' Beneath the Underdog, Run Backwards. And it's also maybe the beginning of something great on its own. If it's a song, you might need to get some kind of app to play the music file backward. But it's completely worth it. Outros become intros. Rising action before verse becomes some kind of strange after-dinner mint. Hearing music in reverse is a time-tried and time-tested tradition. When Run of Run-DMC first heard what the Beastie Boys had done to Paul Revere, Adam Yauch had reversed the 808 rhythm track. It was like he was discovering fire for the first time. And Marley Marl, on his production of MC Shan's The Bridge, accidentally pressed a reverse button when he was sampling a brass stab. Suddenly, the all-powerful stab was the horn equivalent of Scooby-Doo's "Ro-Ro." It went from exclamation point to question mark. Backward asks all questions and answers them, too. Random plucking. This is a related strategy, but for it, you'll need a specific kind of book, a dictionary. I don't know if these exist anymore in the era of the internet and phones that know what words mean, but they used to be these big, important, bound volumes that contain many, if not most, of the words in any given language. We have them here in English. What I used to do was open them randomly and stab my finger down on a word. Maybe it would be shabby. Maybe it would be chalk. Maybe it would be garden. It was almost never randomly, or stab, or word. Though they have as much chance as any of the others. But whatever word it would be my word for that moment. And in the wake of picking it, I forced myself to have an idea about it. Archery. Okay, that seems easy. Maybe it's a song about how the country keeps missing its target by making the wrong people targets. Look. Okay, it's a simple command, one of the simplest, urging people to pay attention. Often those thoughts won't pan out, but that's not the issue. The issue is that there's a thought in the first place. There's an interesting variation on the strategy that I learned from someone famous, though I can't say who. Okay, it's Tom Cruise. It's not Tom Cruise. It's a little more mathematical and a little more mysterious. Take a book. Now, pick a number that's less than the number of the pages it has. Then, a second number between 1 and 20. Then, a third number between 1 and 10. Go to that page, to that line, and to that word. And then use whatever word you selected. When I do this one, I'd like to think the three-number code like it's one of those old master locks and I'm unlocking the day. Yes, and? That's how the day starts. That's the jump. But then there's a matter of how to keep an idea rolling so that it becomes something more than the first glimmer. Ideas are collections. There aren't many composers who compose a whole piece using one single note. Are there? That would be interesting in a John Cage-like way. If you're a young creative, remember this. If you're old, write it down so you'll remember it. Mental reorientation is half the battle. And it's often the other half, too. That's one of the reasons that I've tried to look at the creative disciplines that depend on high-flow creativity. By that, I mean disciplines where people process large amounts of creativity at one time. It's not a judgment on the quality of the creativity, but the rate of ideas passing across the gate. For example, a poet working on a single crystalline image for most of a day, proposing, revising, fine-tuning, trying his or her best way to get exactly right, is engaging in a low-flow creativity. This can be just as valuable. At times, it's the only way to go, but high-flow creativity is usually what I need to start my day. It's creativity before filters and governors appear. Lots of art forms depend on high-flow creativity. Cartooning, for example. If you ever watched a documentary about a classic panel cartoonist, you know how much brainstorming they need to do before they hit upon the one idea that they think has a decent chance of working. Dog inside air traffic control tower? No. Cat in the White House? No. Cat at drive-through window? Somehow still off. Dog at drive-through window? Maybe. Every flat piece of paper that has the beginnings of an actual drawing is made possible by hundreds of balled-up false starts in the conceptual garbage can. That kind of high flow doesn't come naturally to me. Partly that's because music, where I've spent most of my life, has a cost associated with the big pipe. Recording studios operate like utilities. Every minute of flow is a minute of meter running. But I've also spent almost a decade in and around the comedy world, and that has given me access to the creative discipline that makes the most of high flow creativity. Improv comedy. I can already hear the sighs. Look, improv comedy has a bad reputation partly because it's fashionable to take pot shots at it. There's an entire episode of BoJack Horseman built around the premise that improv comedy is a kind of brainless cult populated by irritating nincompoops. I'm sure there are some of those people in the improv world, but what has always impressed me about it is the basic principle of, yes, and. Everyone knows what this is, right? When an improv troupe is working together, and one member takes the sketch in a certain direction, say the starting point is a hospital emergency room, and the first comedian to steer the scene introduces the notion that it's an emergency room for extraterrestrials. The other members have to take it up without challenge or contradiction. And if the second comedian takes the premise of extraterrestrials further, he might suggest that the people in the emergency room are acting out a medical drama for the benefit of the extraterrestrials who are holding them captive. The third comedian has to absorb this into the narrative too. They must accept the shifting parameters and new ingredients and develop new starting points accordingly. Mike Birbiglia, who's an excellent improv comedian and storyteller and also a filmmaker, whose latest film touched on all these worlds. It's called Don't Think Twice, and the title is not only a nod to Bob Dylan, but a nod to Yes And, sees improv comedy as a uniquely collaborative and generous environment. By forcing you to work with the idea of others, it not only makes you more flexible and innovative comedian, but affects the rest of your life too. It changed the way I thought about everything, he told NPR in an interview. It helped me in parenting and being a good husband and a good friend, in a collaborative job. Because Mike is a sane, balanced, and responsible person, he chooses to highlight the way that yes-and thinking improves life with others, and especially his life outside creative work. My aim here is a little different. I'm not appealing to the insane, unbalanced, irresponsible side of people, but I do want to move a little bit away from the collaborative nature of improv comedy. Or maybe it's more accurate to say that I want to suggest that there's an internal yes-and when you start work for the day. Be careful not to throw anything away. At least initially, there's no such thing as a bad idea. Take Eminem. When he first appeared on the scene, lots of the conversation around him dealt with his authenticity. He encouraged that line of thinking because it helped raise his profile, and also because he must have been absolutely secure in the fact that he was as authentic as anyone, as authentic as DMC, as authentic as Rakim, as authentic as Chuck D. He was doing something a little different than any of them, but he was doing it completely authentically. But what some of those early reactions missed was how much he employed yes-and thinking. All right, take a song like Stan, or just take Stan, because there aren't many songs like it. All of us in the entertainment industry, anyone with any level of fame or notoriety, have had encounters with fans that made us feel a little uneasy. I remember one Roots tour back in the late 90s when women kept coming on the bus. They were fans. They had been to the show. They wanted to meet the band. That wasn't as common as you might think. We had groupies who waited for us at the stage door, but they tended to be guys in their 20s with hipster jackets and lots of guesses about where we put the mics when I recorded Sugar Won't Work. For the record, I put the Royer ribbon right behind me and then the Shure football mic by the kick drum. On one tour in one city, I noticed these two attractive women come onto our bus to say hello. One was tall, one was short. They stood out. Two nights later, in the next city, the short woman was on the bus again, this time with a different tall friend. I said hello, but she didn't acknowledge that she was a repeat visitor. And then two nights after that, she came on the bus a third time with a third tall friend. That time, I didn't say anything. It was like the Twilight Zone. That night, I couldn't stop thinking about her, and not in a good way. I wasn't fantasizing. I was fearing. I had an idea in my mind, and it wasn't a good idea. It involved some kind of hostage situation, and then complex Saw type of torture of me and the rest of the band. It wasn't pretty. It wasn't pleasant. I couldn't sleep a wink. I kept banishing the idea, and it kept resurfacing. A few years later, Eminem came out with Stan, and it all came clear to me. You weren't supposed to banish the idea. You were supposed to embrace it. In the privacy of your own home, in the comfort of your own head, you're supposed to play it out to its natural conclusion. The crazy guy loves you as an artist, so much that he loves you as a man, so much that he goes batty when he can't have you, so much that he takes what he can, which happens to be his pregnant girlfriend, and does his worst. Car, trunk, bridge. The story fell into place. It was more eerie and gothic than Trapped in the Drive-Thru, but it operated at least on one of the same principles, which was not to forget to let your mind go where it wanted to go. Eminem didn't put a "should I really say that" cap on his idea. He didn't put a socially acceptable filter on it. He didn't put a good taste governor on it. And I'm not focusing on the quality of the final song, though the quality is high. I'm focusing on that first moment of creative inspiration and creative momentum. He went from nothing to something thanks to an idea he had. Many artists, many songwriters would have turned away from that initial idea, and many of them would have avoided writing an objectionable and disturbing song. But a few, including Eminem, would have allowed themselves the chance of writing a great song. Another example here, in the form of comedy, but not improv comedy, comes from Norm Macdonald. People say he's the comedian's comedian, but he's really the writer's comedian. All the writers I know love him. When I ask them why, their answers are all fairly similar. They like that he isn't afraid to look at things differently. This is a combination of a brief exercise I referred to, Rich and Ben's idea of believing the opposite of what you believe, only for a few seconds. but really believing it as passionately as you believe the things you actually believe. And the broader, yes and, which lets you follow the idea down the rabbit hole. Norm MacDonald has this bit about when people are missing, they often turn up dead in a shallow grave. He wonders why the authorities don't just look in the shallow graves right off the bat, since that's where all the bodies end up. If he ever killed someone, he says, the first thing he would do is to be sure to bury them in a deep grave. It's not a joke in the traditional sense. It's a stream of consciousness. But there's a self-directed, yes, and every time Norm gets to a spot in the story where a different kind of creative person would just stop, he keeps going. Interestingly, the same technique worked less well when Norm wrote a book based on a true story, which was billed as his memoir, was actually a Shaggy Dog deconstruction of the way memoirs worked. There was a ghostwriter who popped up to announce that he didn't really like Norm or find him funny, but he was going to try his best to make a good book in exchange for the money he was getting. As someone who has little experience in deconstructing memoirs and working with collaborators, though mine liked me and I liked him and we worked well together, it seemed a little sour and off-putting. But again, the point of getting started creatively isn't necessarily to have a good idea. That will come. The point is to have ideas. And based on a true story, has no shortage of ideas. If I'm going to mention Norm, I should end with the moth joke. In a sense, it's a joke about creativity, about converting personal pain into creative thinking, about knowing your audience, about subverting expectations. Most of all, it's about the way that jokes build on existing ideas and how they are elaborations and extensions and pearls produced by adding layers and layers. There are shorter versions of the moth joke that have circulated in joke books. In the simplest one, man goes into a dentist's office and announces that he thinks he's a moth. In the complicated versions, it's the moth that goes into the dentist's office, not a man, and his complaint isn't that he thinks he's a moth, because he is, but that he's dissatisfied with some aspect of his life. Maybe his job, maybe his wife. In Norm's version, it's still a moth who shows up at the doctor's office, though now it's a podiatrist's office instead of a dentist's office. Much funnier. And the moth isn't just dissatisfied with his life. He's completely, deeply miserable. Nothing makes sense to him. He's like a ghost passing through his days. Everywhere he looks, he sees experiences devoid of meaning. Even his despair can no longer comfort him. Norm's version becomes a kind of bleak short story from Russian literature, a full-blown existential crisis. This version of the joke goes to great lengths to detail the moth's sadness, but it ends up in the same place as the shorter versions. When the moth was done telling his sad tale, the doctor says, "You sound like you need help, but you'd be better off seeing a psychiatrist. Why'd you come here?" And the moth says,
"Because the light was on."
Giving and getting props. Most of the techniques I've outlined so far take place in the mind. They are consciousness stretching exercises, creative calisthenics. You can do them while you sit in a chair or ride an elevator. There are more left-field techniques, too, that require props. When I was working on my memoir, Momenta Blues, I was talking to Richard Nichols about how to start chapters. It was a strange idea for me to retell my own life. I hadn't done it before. I knew instinctively that it was wrong to just open each new sentence with the phrase, "And then," you know, like, "and then I was 25, and then I went to Europe." But I didn't have any strong instincts about how to do it otherwise. Ben had ideas, and they were generally good ones. But I wanted to have more of a role in how each individual section started. We talked about it. And Rich brought up cut-ups. At first, I thought he was talking about class clowns. He explained that he meant William S. Burroughs. And then he went back further to the roots of the idea in the Dada art movement. And then he explained how it was sort of the wild third rail of pop songwriting, after he got past the way Bob Dylan used modernist symbolism to make sweeping, if indirect, statements about culture and the human condition, and the way John Lennon used nonsense verse that, because it seemed deceptively light, let him be crushingly dark. And then he explained the idea of the wild third rail over and over again until I understood it. And then he gave a more detailed explanation of cut-up, specifically how Burroughs developed a method of his own. He took an existing piece of writing, something that had already been printed, like a book or a magazine article, or even a few paragraphs that you've written yourself, and you cut it up and rearrange the words, and you force yourself to see the meaning in the arbitrary jumble. And then he identified some prominent songwriters who used the method. I think he mentioned David Bowie and Kurt Cobain, though I wasn't listening as closely anymore because I was still thinking about the explanation of the method. And then I had a kind of epiphany about the fact that making a new context for old words make these words new again. And then I started to think about how you could apply that same idea to other forms of creativity. The dominoes were falling. The more I thought about how Bowie used cut-up, the more sense it made. His lyrics are not, for me, the strongest part of his legacy as an artist. That's not to say that there aren't great ones. There are. I am especially fond of DJ, for obvious reason. I love Queen Bitch. Who doesn't love Queen Bitch? And Life on Mars, and then. But other songs seem meaningless, sometimes in irritating ways. I won't single out any, except most of the Tonight album, and all of Never Let Me Down. Maybe it's just my bias, but those were some of the first Bowie albums I bought on their release day. And the period after Let's Dance made him a huge pop star. And I was disappointed. On the other hand, Bowie kept going. He kept trying. He was never not a creative. Never not an artist. Never not a person who believed in the importance of producing. He was cutting up texts and putting them back together, and sometimes they made great songs, and other times they made less than great songs. But they made songs. Boys keep swinging. This leads to the second and perhaps most important point about these techniques. They are there to keep you moving forward, because the whole point is to keep moving forward. The point is to generate ideas in a rush, and not necessarily to think too much too early about whether or not they work. They work in the sense that they exist. At the time when the Roots took the job at the Tonight Show, I was suddenly immersed in two different demographics, comedy and cooking. Both were new to me. Both of them were people, or at least the types of people, that I didn't hang out with before I entered the television world. I started to observe and notice that both sets of groups have their own creative cultures. Chefs and comedians hung out with one another. But there were differences in the way that it happened. Comedians had a woodshed spot to work on their craft. Hanging with Dave Chappelle before his appearance on Saturday Night Live, I noticed that he surrounded himself with his inner circle. At the Comedy Cellar, Chris Rock, Jerry Seinfeld, all of them are there working on new material. Woodshedding, testing out new material, bouncing off each other. I don't know if chefs have quite the same freedom. I mean, take a place like 11 Madison Park. It's been awarded 3 Michelin stars and named the best restaurant in the world. It's very creative. But they're almost like a 24-hour operation. Even when the last customer leaves at 2 a.m. and they're done cleaning at 4 a.m., the next chef is in. But they make it happen. I discovered recently that there's a third hidden floor where there are chefs improvising. Find your woodshed and shed some wood in it. Calculated spontaneity. Question. What's the best process for finding ideas? There are people who say that a creative person should just make things at any rate all the time and that the best products can be located inside the work later. There are other people who insist that most of the creativity lies in the meticulous planning. Broadly speaking, these are backloaded and front-loaded types of creatives. To make for the most confusion, let's look at the backloaded first. I have a long-standing obsession with the Bomb Squad, a production team responsible for creating Public Enemy's dense and powerful sound in the late 80s and early 90s, and for working with a number of other groups, from Son of Berserk to the Young Black Teenagers. What was most fascinating to me was looking at the group's song notes. They weren't just jotted down ideas or hints about what they wanted to do. They were detailed blueprints of individual songs. Back then, Pro Tools wasn't used, so someone had to do the yeoman's work of counting out bars, matching piece to piece, and so on. The song map for Night of the Living Bassheads is an amazing document that illustrates the level of intellect at work. If anyone thinks that early Public Enemy is over-emotional thug music, These notes disprove that idea fast and forever. Nick Cinsano, who worked as an engineer on that album and has co-taught a class about the record with me, revealed that there was almost no post-production on the record, which explains the existence of these notes and makes them even more impressive. Other bands at the time, the Beastie Boys, for example, looped everything together and then did lots of surgery after the fact. They went back in and cleaned up and layered. They slowed things down, sped things up. That creates one kind of sound. Think of the Dust Brothers production on Paul's Boutique. The other way is the Bomb Squad Public Enemy way. I know some of the reasons for it. It saved time, which saved money, but the result is that even before the song was recorded, these documents offer a bar-for-bar rundown of exactly what's going to happen in the song. Maybe it specifies that the scratch from Run DMC's Sucker MCs at the end of the first chorus comes in at bar 48. Maybe it specifies exactly where to slow down to fit in the sample from David Bowie's Fame. Most normal people, even normal visionaries, think Dust Brothers again, would have cut and pasted an edited tape. That post-recording process would have taken hours to do. The Bomb Squad ran ahead of technology, literally and figuratively. They knew they were on primitive equipment. They knew they were using multiple drum machines in series. And despite all of that, the album sounds like it was made on the spot. Like they were confronted with Chuck D's epic lyrics and improvised a brilliant soundscape around them. It sounds spontaneous and powerful, which makes it all the more impressive that it was absolutely locked down from the first. There are many counterexamples to this, but the best one is Rick James' Super Freak. The tape was rolling. Rick and his band were playing. They only had 15 minutes per tape reel. And right when they started to gel and lock into each other, the tape ran out. Rick was frustrated, almost furious. But he was listening back to it, and there was a part around a sax solo that produced 8 perfect bars. They just looped that, like a hip-hop record, and made the song over that. I would have assumed that Public Enemy was more like that, partly because the things that I've been involved with tend to be more like that. D'Angelo's Voodoo, for example, wasn't laid out all in advance. We felt our way through it and found the record. As a matter of fact, I'm in the very room that we recorded that very record right now, Electric Lady Studios. I'm torn between these two models. I love both of them. Both of them have made for wonderful work in the world. My analytical brain, which sometimes overtakes the rest, knows that the artwork I get off on the most happens when people do their homework. Here, I think again of J. Dilla. He had all these weird nuances in his music, but every one was planned. And then on the other hand, there's the lesson that Jimmy Jam taught me, which he learned from Prince, that a song starts with a drum part and a bass part. And then you go from there, the skeleton of the song lurching forward, the musicians going where all their minds tell them to go. When the bass player zigs or zags, the keyboard player, or guitarist or vocalist, follows. The band, in this case, the Time, are accidental tourists. That's how they discovered new sights and those side streets. Creative life sometimes means knowing when the deviation from the plan should become the new plan. There's a related idea here. The same way that the Bomb Squad generated intricate and comprehensive documents about the song they were about to make, creative work can begin by imagining the end of the process. Other books call this visioning, or productive imagining. I call it the thing I did when I was younger that I was both proud of and slightly embarrassed by. Earlier in my career, before I would start work on a new Roots record, I would imagine the eventual Rolling Stone review for my record. That was the gold standard then. The way that you knew you mattered as a creative artist. That would change later, to The Source, then to Pitchfork. But for a while there, it was only ever Rolling Stone. I was interested in how many stars we would get. It was hard to get a 5-star review. Almost impossible. They gave it to The Clash's London Calling. They gave it to Black Uhuru's Red. They gave it to a bunch of Al Green records, including Let's Stay Together and Call Me. But that didn't stop me from dreaming. For me, though, it was more than just a 5-star pipe dream. It was a comprehensive exercise. I would think as a critic, Imagine which songs were tapped as standouts, which ones were slow growers, which ones would seem out of step with the rest of the material. But I went further than that. I laid out the review on a sheet of paper, which meant thinking of the headline, Roots Revival. I would even sketch out the illustration that accompanied the review. Those were especially funny. I knew we were a big group, so I wondered how the magazine would get us all in. I imagined Mad Magazine-style caricatures of me and Tariq with the rest of the group flanking us. This is something I have done forever, but I've never had a great name for it. Proto-creativity? Pre-packaging? Whatever it is, it can be useful. If you're a writer, imagine the blurbs that will be on the paperback. If you're a painter, imagine what people will say when they're standing in front of your canvas. This is another example of being present, but not present. You are the creator, but also the eventual audience. When you're on the outside of your work looking in, you'll be able to see the overall shape of it, which will help you to realize that you're on the right track, or, alternatively, you're not. It's also a way of journeying to the center of what the idea will eventually become. I remember those plastic car and airplane models from when I was young. Some needed glue. Some snapped together. Most of them had plastic flash around the pieces, thin bits of extra plastic that were there because the mold wasn't perfect. Imagining ahead in the process is a way of getting rid of the plastic flash, of melting off what's unnecessary. Different creators have different versions of this. For Ron Adria, the master chef who pioneered molecular gastronomy and the creative force behind Iburi, has long made drawings of his ideas about food. Amazingly intricate things, diagrams of plates, pyramids of flowcharts that detail the dining experience. I've done a few events with him, and one of the most interesting things is encountering this part of his creative brain. How does it relate to cooking? How might it distract him? What if people love the flowcharts, but they hate the cooking? Let's go to Echo. I don't mean the Eminem song or even the Echo and the Bunnymen song with a hip, which is one of the earliest places many people saw the word hip-hop. It's from 1981, and it's about Bunnymen. I mean the Amazon product. You know this thing? It's a tiny tower that sits in your house and takes instructions from it. You have to call it by its name, Alexa, which is Amazon's version of Siri, or Cortana. It keeps learning from the cloud. It can turn on the lights in your house or order food. Eventually, it'll be able to do everything. And at that point, houses might have no humans in them. Just a lot of echoes that speak to each other. I raise this not to terrify anyone, but to mention that Amazon has a process that lets its team imagine big ideas. When someone at the company has one of these far-fetched ideas, I know, let's make a tiny tower that sits in your house and takes instructions. They don't start research and development or even test market the idea. They start by bringing the product to the press department. They write up a release as if the product exists. Kind of brilliant. When it comes out, if it comes out, consumers won't care about the nuts and bolts. They'll care about what the product does for them, easily described with simple metaphors. The kind of thing that you can put in a press release. They have said that this idea is kind of concrete dreaming. I call it creativity. Amazon has called this process backward thinking. I will go on to mention the other kinds of backward thinking over the course of this book. Although if you're listening to the book backwards, you've already heard them. So what is the answer? What's the better approach for getting started down the creative path? Should you plan and plan before you dive in, or dive in and take pictures of the splash? In the end, I can only answer correctly, which is to answer with a bit of compromise. You should plan and plan and plan, but never forget to leave a little opening in your plan for the human element. Something that sounds robotically perfect, something that is airless, isn't going to connect with an audience, and might not even connect with you as an artist in the moments after you make it. You want proof of life. I try to do that when I drum. I keep the pocket perfectly, but I also throw in little variations. There's this one guy online who tried to call me out on Dynamite, a root song from Things Fall Apart. He claimed that it was just a loop. I insisted that I played it through, because I did. He didn't believe me. Everyone becomes an expert on the internet. I gave him evidence. I told him to listen to the second round of choruses at the fade of the song, where he would hear a slight fill. I knew the exact right place to point him to because when we were making the song, I knew that I would have to deal with the claims that it wasn't played live. And yes, I'm aware that putting a little feel just to fend off future internet trolls is a little strange and defensive, a little caught between the two modes of creativity, and not sure which one to embrace, but that's just an illustration of the power of the question. Advanced calculation or roll with its spontaneity? It's a death match that will never be fully resolved, and which gives so much creative work its life. Through the Looking Glass. Begin each day by believing the opposite of everything you believe. Network. You are not alone. Much of building your own creative identity is understanding yourself as a part of a collaborative environment. You need counselors, foils, and competitors. You need high-level models for inspiration and flatfoots to tell you the truth. You breathe in all kinds of air so you're never in a vacuum. Prince gets credit as a singular genius, and he obviously was. But if you study him with any level, a specificity, you see how important all of his creative partnerships have been. Just because he's the one who put them into place, the one with the will to make the calls and keep the people practicing for endless hours, doesn't mean that his creative relationships weren't a vital part of who he became as an artist. Other people are answers to questions, and the biggest challenge is thinking what question they're answering. It's like Johnny Carson's old Carnac routine, where he would read the answer and then supply the question. Maybe the singer you know is useful for teaching you about harmonies, but maybe she's actually better for teaching you about how to bounce back from disappointment. Maybe the comedian you know is most useful for talking about geometry. Each creative person has already been through the process of curation. They have already sorted their ideas and selected which ones they're going to show you. Dig for the ones that are underneath the surface because they may be of great service to you. The majority of my creative life has been spent working with others. In my band, on TV shows, scoring movies. As I mentioned in previous chapters, when I first met Tariq Trotter, my partner in The Roots, we were high school students together. I knew Tariq a little bit because on one of my first days, I was down in the office taking care of some paperwork, and he was called in to answer some charges regarding some funny business with his girlfriend in the bathroom. He didn't do that unless you were the man. He was also a gifted artist and, as it turned out, a fantastic MC. But I'm getting ahead of myself. In those days, hip-hop was in its infancy, and it was about to be kicked into adolescence by a blind man. This brings us to what I've called the single most influential moment in the history of hip-hop. Guess what it is for a little bit. No. Wrong. But close. It's The Cosby Show. And specifically that famous episode where Theo and Denise are out driving, and they get sideswiped by Stevie Wonder's driver. That kind of thing mostly only happens in sitcoms. Another thing that only happens in sitcoms is when the driver of a world-famous musical genius sideswipes you, that driver invites you and your entire family down to the studio to see his recording session. The Huxtables don't decline the invitation. Who would? So there they were, on the other side of the glass, watching Stevie sing. Cliff pretended not to be impressed, but he was impressed. Claire swooned. The kids were beside themselves, and then Stevie showed them a new toy. At one point, Theo had said, "Jamming on the one." I don't even remember now why he said it. And a few minutes later, Stevie picked up that sample and inserted it into a song. When Stevie put Theo's voice down into the sample bed, hip-hop changed forever. There were so many of us out there, so many fledgling rappers and producers who saw that episode and had the tops of their heads lifted. I had known about DJs and turntables for years, but I'd never seen anything like what Stevie was doing with Theo's voice. It remade hip-hop production right there, on the spot. And I'm not the only one. J. Dilla had the same experience when he was still the young James DeWitt Yancey in Detroit. Just Blaze had the same experience when he was still Justin Smith in Paterson, New Jersey. Whatever wheels were in our heads started turning. Santa was also onto it. Right around that time, Casio put that technology in homes with its first sampling keyboard, the SK-1. Do you remember that commercial? It had a white kid noodling on his keyboard and then putting his dog Rufus into the song. Rufus barks. Woof! The keyboard barks. Woof! I don't know if that commercial was some coded reference to Rufus Thomas. The music the kid plays sounds sort of Memphis influence. And Thomas's big hit was Walking the Dog. But I wasn't doing a deep read of the commercial. I was doing a deep desire of the keyboard, and it came true. I got that thing for Christmas. I used it to take samples of voices, but pretty soon I was also sampling drum beats. That was the beginning of a new beginning, and a quantum leap forward for my understanding of hip-hop production, though I'm pretty sure I wouldn't have known the phrase quantum leap yet, since that show was still a few years away. Tariq, by this point, was a talented visual artist. He mainly made molds of African medallions, but his creativity had morphed into something verbal as well. He wasn't writing rhymes yet, but he was sitting at one central table in the cafeteria and showing off his skills. By skills, I mean mostly that he was playing the dozens. See, kids would come by and say something to him, casual-like, but with a little edge. You know, the way kids hang out. Maybe they'd take a casual shot at his shoes or his hair. Tariq would look at them laser-eyed and then fire back with a devastating joke or a comment. If a kid was growing too fast and his pants were moving up his ankles, Tariq would make a comment about a levee, because when levees broke, there were floods. If a kid had thick glasses, he would ask him about a nebula, because they were far away and you needed powerful lenses to see them. These thoughts grew into rhymes. I remember one kid whose sneaker sole flapped around loosely. Tariq told the kid that his shoes were talking, and then before you knew it, the talking shoes and salt became an image, tongue and all, that he built into a couplet. I don't remember it exactly. His insults were always two steps down the line, which is to say that they were themselves a great example of creativity. Before I mastered the SK-1, I was just one of the kids in the circle around Tariq, marveling at his abilities. There's a clip online where the whole early Roots group is in an alley and we're lobbing topics at Tariq, and he's firing them right back at us with the most brilliant lyrics. He can handle any suggestion, and did. He could rap about a table, a haircut, or aeronautics. What mattered most wasn't the topic, but the fact that he could take any topic. This is his version of improv comedy's Yes and Imperative. And it's nearly perfect proof of his creativity. Once I had my instrument, though, I was more than an onlooker. I was the other half of something. As amazed as I was by his verbal athletics, he was equally amazed by what I could do with that little keyboard. Kids were already putting some kind of musical backing to Tariq's performances. He would chant his insults, and kids would tap out a James Brown beat on the table. But once I figured that out, I could just put that beat into the SK-1 and program it to back him. He noticed, and I noticed that he noticed, and a bond began to form. It was a bond of mutual respect, but also mutual need. He saw that his performances were greatly improved by backing percussion. And I saw how my growing sampler skills could turn into something that had real social and cultural power. We worked out a routine for our collaboration. He would come to lunch and start razzing kids. And at some point, he'd get into a rhythm. And that rhythm would suggest either to him or to me a sample. I remember one week at the beginning of our senior year, Tariq was building an insult that was drawing on everything in the news. Maybe baby Jessica, who had fallen down a well in Texas. Maybe Robert Bork. Maybe Iran-Contra. His dexterity was a rarity, as they say. At some point, one of us started beatboxing Audio 2's Top Billing. which was a song on everybody's mind back then. Suddenly, I had a purpose. I left the cafeteria, which was on the 8th floor, and ran all the way down to the basement, to the recording studio, to drum the beat of Top Billing to the SK-1. Then, I hustled back to the cafeteria so that Tariq could perform over it. That day, the collaboration didn't work. He hadn't been able to fit his rhymes around Top Billing. He had something else in mind. Busy Bee's Suicide. But we were out of time. The next day, though, he tipped me off earlier to Big Daddy Kane's Wrath of Kane. I went down to the studio and brought it back up. This was a collaboration, a partnership in the truest sense. We each had our roles. We negotiated briefly, but most of the energy in the process was spent participating. He waited eagerly for my beat so that he could get going with his lyrics. I excitedly assembled my beat because I couldn't wait to hear it with his lyrics. Collaborations work best this way, when there's a mutual desire to see what the other side adds. You know that what you're making on your own has value, but the sum is more than the parts, and every part knows it. Community activism. That's the traditional definition of collaboration, right? Two creative forces come into a summit meeting where each benefits the other. And that's how Tariq and I worked for those first years. We added in musicians. They contributed, of course. We added in mentors like Richard Nichols. But the core remained that formative one. His words, my beats. Each creative endeavor develops its own unique DNA. And this was ours. As we embarked on our career as a hip-hop band, the idea of collaboration broadened. Our second album, Do You Want More?, was mostly an internal affair. We brought in people like Dice Raw and Ursula Ruckert, along with M-bass artists like Cassandra Wilson, Steve Coleman, and Greg Osby. But we operated within the confines of the group. For Illadelph Half-Life, though, our scope broadened. From the beginning, we modeled ourselves on the Native Tongues Collective, the corner of the hip-hop world that included A Tribe Called Quest, De La Soul, and Jungle Brothers. We imagined that we were at the center of a similar world, one called Foreign Objects. Very early on, we tried to set up touring packages that included a number of different groups underneath the Foreign Objects umbrella. But as it turned out, the Roots were the only group in that set that lasted. Still, as we came through Illadelph Half-Life, we were aware that we all had connections to different parts of the music world, and we tried to unite them all under the banner of the record. That album includes contributions from Bahamadia, from Raphael Sadiq, from D'Angelo, from Q-Tip, from Common, from Steve Coleman, from Joshua Redman, from Cassandra Wilson. People took verses or sang hooks or performed solos, but collaboration wasn't a plan that we drew up and executed. It was just an organic fact, if not exactly an organics one. We knew musicians, they knew us. We made records, they did too. For the album after that, though, the idea of collaboration shifted into overdrive. Illadelph Half-Life sold decently well, around 300,000 copies. I mean, eventually it went gold. In today's numbers, that's like a billion. But to a record company at the time, it was a holding pattern number. You might not kick a group to the curb for selling 300,000, but you wouldn't buy them a mansion and a fleet of luxury automobiles either. It was just big enough to let the label know that we were on to something. Also, we had been moved within the Geffen family to the MCA label, part of an endless series of label shenanigans. At that time, Rich, our manager, decided that we needed to go to the record company and make some demands about our future. They were modest demands, but they were unconventional. I had moved to a house on St. Albans in South Philadelphia. Rich told the label that they had to start paying for jam sessions at the house, and that the music created there would form the basis for the new album. Paying for jam sessions meant more than just running equipment. They sprang for transportation in the forms of two vans and also a chef to cook for whoever dropped by. All the factors lined up like a powerful electromagnet, and soon enough we were attracting all the local talent. The Roots were there, of course, but also a bunch of other people at the start of their careers. There was Jill Scott, who was working at a clothing store, but knew that she wanted to devote more attention to singing. There was Jamal, who was working as a pizza delivery guy but was writing and playing songs. He turned out to be music's soul child. Bilal was there. And NDIRE,